Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. The name of the article we're going to discuss this week is The Real Reason Geithner is Afraid of Elizabeth Warren. It's by John R. Talbot, who is the best-selling author of The Coming Crash in the Housing Market, and it was reported in Huffington Post. As reported on HuffPost last week, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has expressed opposition to the possible nomination of Elizabeth Warren to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, according to the source with knowledge of Geithner's views. One can assume that Geithner, being very close to the nation's biggest banks, is concerned that Warren, if chosen, will exercise her new policing and enforcement powers to restrict those abusive practices at our commercial banks that have been harmful to consumers and depositors. Certainly, Warren is not the commercial banking industry's first pick to serve in this new role. And unlike other legislation in which an industry's lobbying effort would naturally slow or cease once the legislation is passed, the new financial reform bill is continuing to attract enormous lobbying actions from the banks. The reason is simple. The bill has been written to put a great deal of power as to how strongly it is implemented in the hands of the regulators, some of which remain to be chosen. The bank lobby will work incredibly hard to see that Warren, the person most responsible for initiating and fighting for the idea of a consumer financial protection group, is denied the opportunity to head it. But this is not the only reason that Geithner is opposed to Warren's nomination. I believe Geithner sees the appointment of Elizabeth Warren as a threat to the very scheme he has utilized to date to hide bank losses, thus keeping the bank solvent and out of bankruptcy court, and their existing management teams employed and well-paid. To see how this scheme works during the current crisis, we must go back and examine previous crises and recessions in order to understand their cause. As Kenneth Rogoff explains in his new book, This Time is Different, most crises are preceded by a boom or bubble period in which asset classes, such as homes in this case, reached unsustainable pricing levels. The main driver of most of these asset bubbles is loose bank lending, in which banks offer money to asset buyers on very liberal terms, thus guaranteeing that the asset prices will inflate abnormally. Eventually, all bubbles burst, and in the worst cases, we are led into financial crises. The banks make things even more difficult because as prices fall, the banks end up with substantial increases in problem loans. To deal with this increase in problem loans, the banks typically pull back on all lending, not just lending in the affected sector. The banks, now primarily concerned with their own survival if they wrote off the problem loans, literally stop almost all new lending, thus driving the economy into a deep recession. It is difficult to sustain economic activity when there is no credit being supplied by the banking system. the banks, instead of lending to businesses and consumers, shift their investments to very safe instruments like U.S. Treasury securities. The result is a risk-free cash flow that over time eventually repairs the bank's balance sheets by increasing their profitability and thus restoring their book equity. Typically, during crises, the Federal Reserve also lowers interest rates and the cost of bank borrowing so as to make this risk-free profit spread to banks even greater. In the current financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates to almost 0% per annum, thus assuring that the banks can profit enormously by doing almost nothing, not lending, and sitting on risk-free treasury investments. While good for the banks, one can see how damaging this lack of credit extension can be to an economy trying to recover from an economic crisis. What is most damaging about this approach to an economy attempting to recover from a recession is that it ensures that the policy of tight money from the banks will continue for some time. Time is needed for the banks to earn their way out of their loan losses and insolvency problems if they decide not to quickly write off the bad loans. In Japan, after their banking crisis of 1994, it took more than a decade for the banks to repair their balance sheets and resume normal lending, thus retarding economic growth for decades. This is exactly the plan that Geithner and Larry Summers have proposed for the current crisis. If you remember, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary at the time, had announced that the $700 billion TARP funds would be used to buy toxic assets like bad mortgage loans from the commercial banks. But this never happened, and now the amount of bad bank loans has increased in the trillions. Immediately after receiving authorization of the funding for TARP from Congress, Paulson reversed direction and decided to make direct equity investments in the banks rather than using the TARP funds to acquire their bad loans. So where are the trillions of dollars of bad loans that the banks had on their books? They are still there. The Federal Reserve took possession temporarily of some of them as collateral for lending to the banks in an attempt to clean up the banks for their supposed stress tests. But as of now, the trillions of dollars of underwater mortgages, CDOs, and worthless credit default swaps are still on the banks' books. Geithner is going to the familiar banking crisis playbook and hoping that the banks can earn their way out of their solvency problems over time, so the banks are continuing to slowly write off their problem loans, but at a rate that will take years, if not decades, to clean up the problem. And this is where defeat of the nomination of Elizabeth Warren becomes critical for Geithner. For Geithner's strategy to work, the banks have to find increasing sources of profitability in their business segments to balance out their annual loan loss recognition from their existing bad loans in an environment in which they continue to recognize new losses in prime residential mortgages, commercial real estate lending, sovereign debt investments, bridge loans to private equity groups, leveraged buyout lending, and credit card defaults. The banks have made no secret as to where they will find this increase in cash flow. They intend to soak their small retail customers, their consumers and small business borrowers, their credit card holders, and their small depositors with increased costs and fees, and are continuing many of the bad mortgage practices that led to the crisis. ARMs, option pay deals, zero down payments, second mortgages, teaser rates, etc. American and Banking Market News reported last week that the rule changes in the financial reform bill may lead banks to start implementing fees that had essentially disappeared from the industry early in the new millennium, such as fees for not meeting minimum balance requirements on a checking account, or reinstituting fees for certain online banking transactions that are currently free, or charging to receive a paper statement, or to talk to a live teller, as Bank of America's CEO has recently proposed. I'll return to that in a second. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I am reviewing an article by John R. Talbot, reported in HuffPost, about the real reason Geithner is afraid of Elizabeth Warren. Continuing, it is exactly these types of unwarranted fees on small consumers and poorly designed products that Elizabeth Warren will fight against as head of the new Consumer Finance Protection Group. And it is why Geithner sees her as so threatening. Unless the banks are allowed to raise fees and charges on their smaller consumer customers, Geithner's and Summers' scheme for dealing with the banking crisis by hiding problem loans permanently on the bank's balance sheets will be exposed for what it is, an attempt at preserving the jobs of current bank executives at the cost of dragging out this recovery needlessly for years in the future. For the investment banks without small consumers and depositors to soak, Geithner and Summer have offered an environment with fewer competitors, more dominant market shares for the surviving firms, and near monopoly pricing of their investment banking and derivative products to corporate clients and institutional investors to ensure continued and increasing profitability and growth. Warren's appointment wouldn't just be a setback. It would devastate Geithner's entire plan on how to deal with trillions of dollars of bad assets the banks still won't recognize as losers. That is why I think she is going to face enormous resistance even inside of the administration. The next one to oppose Warren after Geithner will be Larry Summers for this very reason. Then they will see if they can get Bernanke and finally Obama on board. The pitch to Obama and Bernanke will not be personal. It will be the same phony argument that Paulson and Bernanke used to justify TARP to Congress. They will say that if Warren is appointed, the entire world of banking and finance as we know it will come to an end. I'm reminded of when Bernie Sanders offered an amendment to audit the Fed to the financial reform bill earlier this year. While it was just one of many amendments being considered, the administration came out and said it was not against any of the amendments being discussed, with one exception. They would fight the audit the Fed idea to the death. Why? The same reason a complete audit of the Fed would show that we still have not dealt with the bad loans on the bank's books. As to the other two potential nominees on Obama's shortlist for the position, Michael S. Barr is Geithner's boy, currently working for him as an assistant secretary of treasury. More importantly, he is Bob Rubin's boy, having served as Rubin's assistant in the Clinton administration. If you are Rubin's boy, you are the bank lobby's boy, as this position of Rubin's boy was previously held by Summers and then Geithner. Eugene Kimmelman seems like a nice enough person who has no background in finance as the second choice. If the banking lobby can't get their guy in, the next best thing is to get a completely clueless person in who is too afraid to act boldly given he couldn't tell a CDO from a CEO. He has been the top lobbyist for the Consumers Union, so he is pro-lobbying and, as a positive comment, really understands how toasters and garage door openers work, which, as an aside, has been Professor Warren's analogy all along
for why regulation is necessary and not a bad thing.
Elizabeth Warren won't just protect consumers. Her Oklahoma-bred sense of honesty, fairness, and decency just might reinvigorate and redirect a government and a banking industry that for too long has seen the average American taxpayer and the typical small consumer as the enemy to be taken advantage of at every turn. If you want to help make sure Elizabeth Warren is appointed to head the new Consumer Finance Protection Agency, why don't you take a minute and sign a petition that will be presented to the president and then use the email accompanying that online petition as an opportunity to invite your friends to do the same. Go to www.act.credoaction.com, act.credoaction.com/campaign/pick_Warren. I know that's a mouthful, but it's www.credoaction.com/campaign/pick_Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N. And this is all from an article by John R. Talbot in the Huffington Post. And as a personal aside, if we can get Elizabeth Warren into this position as head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, everyone in the middle and lower class will benefit tremendously.
And with that, I'd like to move on to the second part of our show. We have been looking at a book by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. It's called The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke. And I'd like to start with a credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. I also recommend that people go to the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows which have been produced to help you become more educated on issues regarding debt and budget and how to deal with debt past, present, and future. So in the last several weeks, I've been talking about the history behind the 2005 bankruptcy bill. Professor Warren was talking about it and wrote about it just before it had passed and at a point where it wasn't apparently going to pass. And one of the reasons for that was a very heavy input by women's groups, particularly through a New York senator at the time, not Hillary Clinton, but Senator Schumer. Just as a quick review, what had happened was that the bill had an amendment to it. This is the bankruptcy bill, which was going to disallow people who were getting judgments against them for cases that were levied against people protesting abortions
and civil and criminal damage that emanated as a result.
The bankruptcy law did not allow the judgments, those judgments, to be liquidated or discharged. And this created a pause in the passage of the law because women's groups essentially backed that provision. What Professor Warren's position was, not necessarily pro-abortion or pro-life, but that a group of consolidated people, like the women's groups, who were focusing on financial issues that were negative to women, helped to stave off an onslaught law that was essentially drafted by the credit lobby and heavily favored the credit industry, which, on the other hand, was highly detrimental to women in particular. In the two decades before she wrote her book, the number of single filing women declaring bankruptcy had grown by more than 600%. Women with children were more likely to lose their homes and more likely to be late on their bills. And single women with children were three times more likely to go bankrupt than men without children. So you see how it was an important focus, the finances, not these other issues. That law, at that point, was seen to clearly be absurd and awful and something that was going to hurt women. So Professor Warren pointed out that women's groups have too few dollars and too little woman power to fight every injustice, but there is another lesson in the tale of that bankruptcy bill. Women's issues are not just about childbearing or domestic violence. if it were framed properly, middle-class economic reform just might become the issue that could galvanize millions of mainstream women to join the fight for women's issues. The numbers are certainly there. Every year, more women will file bankruptcy papers than will receive college diplomas. More women with children will search for a bankruptcy lawyer than will seek subsidized daycare. And more women will be victimized by predatory lenders than will seek protection from an abusive husband or boyfriend. And we'll get back to this in a second. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Getting back to the issue, Professor Warren's point is not to discredit other worthy causes or to pit one disadvantaged group against another. She does not suggest that battered women deserve less help or that subsidized daycare is unimportant. Her point is simply that family economics should not be left to giant corporations and paid lobbyists and senators like, at that time, it was Joe Biden, who is now vice president, who was for helping women who were being abused but was totally in favor of the bankruptcy law. These groups and individuals should not be allowed to sell out women in the morning and be heralded as their friend in the evening. Middle-class women need help. And right now, no one is putting their economic interests first, and that has continued since when this book was published in 2002. Her point is that political groups on the conservative end of the political spectrum should also step up. Groups such as Family Research Council and Focus on the Family organize their political and educational activities around the family. But economics are nestled at the core of family values. Any group that is serious about lowering divorce rates should focus on reducing the economic stress that strains a marriage. Any group that cares about children should be vitally interested in how home mortgages are marketed and how tens of thousands of kids are getting kicked out of their houses. In fact, since this book was written again, it's a lot more young people than that. Any group that thinks mom ought to have the option to stay at home with the kids should be powerfully concerned about the debt trap that chains millions of women from the middle class to their offices. A few religious leaders have involved themselves in family economics. In letters to Congress around 2002-2003, several faith-based organizations, including Catholics, Jews, and Unitarians, joined to argue that social justice for the socially and economically disadvantaged is part of the cherished moral tradition shared by all of our religions. Citing a passage from the Bible about forgiveness of debts, the group called on Congress to abandon the proposed bankruptcy bill because the hardship it would impose on families was out of line with their religious beliefs. Again, this is 2002-2003. When these people saw that the vitality of the family was at stake, these groups mobilized their moral authority against those who would rob families of their economic independence. Professor Warren says other faith-based organizations should heed the call and follow their lead. Liberal or conservative, faith-based or secular, any group that sees its mission as families should have interest rate regulation and bankruptcy protection at the very top of its agenda. Predatory lending is a family issue. Usury is a family issue. Bankruptcy is a family issue. These laws affect families, people with children, more than anyone else. There is likely no other issue, divorce, welfare reform, child custody, that will directly touch more middle-class families than the mortgage and credit card interest rates that drain away their economic viability and sap the intimacy and joy from family life. Unfortunately, this horrific bill eventually passed in 2005. The 2005 bankruptcy bill
as we mentioned, was actually first drafted in 1997 and first introduced in 1998. The U.S. House of Representatives approved a version titled the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 1999, and the Senate approved a slightly different version in 2000. After the differences in the bills were reconciled, Congress passed the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2000. However, President Clinton employed what is known as a pocket veto by waiting for the lame duck congressional session to adjourn without signing the bill, a legislative maneuver tantamount to a veto. And a lot of this, as we mentioned in the past, was due to his wife, Hillary Clinton, who was First Lady at the time, who had met with Professor Warren and concluded that this bill was an awful bill. It really hurt people tremendously. And of course, it was written by the credit industry. Then in the years since 2000, the bill was reintroduced in each Congress, but was repeatedly shelved due to threats of a filibuster from its opponents and because of disagreements over various amendments, including the one we just talked about, backed by Senate Democrats, that would have made it harder for anti-abortion groups to discharge court fines related to felony convictions. But as the political world unfolds, increased funds and lobbying, the increase in Republican majorities in the Senate and House after the 2004 elections breathed new life into the bill, which was introduced in its current form by the chairman of the Finance Committee, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. The bill was greatly supported by President George W. Bush. Tom DeLay also championed the controversial legislation. The bill passed by large margins, 302 to 126 in the House and 74 to 25 in the Senate, was signed into law by President Bush. And it should be highly underscored that support for the act mostly came from banks, credit card companies, and other creditors. The 2005 bankruptcy bill was opposed by a wide variety of groups, including consumer advocates, legal scholars, retired bankruptcy judges, and the editorial pages of many national and regional newspapers. While the criticisms of the bill were wide-ranging, the central objections of its opponents focus on the bill's sponsors' contention that bankruptcy fraud was widespread. The strict means test that would force more debtors to file under Chapter 13, at least in theory, and under Chapter 13, a percentage of debts must be paid over a period of 3 to 5 years, as opposed to a Chapter 7, under which debts are paid only out of existing assets,
which frankly, since then, has turned out to be untrue. Most people who would have filed Chapter 7 before the law are still able to file Chapter 7 bankruptcies. But there were also additional penalties and responsibilities that the bill placed on debtors. And the bill did have many provisions which seemed to favor credit card companies. The opponents of the bill also pointed out that the credit card industry spent probably more than $100 million lobbying for the bill over the course of 8 years. And there were also significant changes and criticism of BAP CPA's changes to Chapter 11 business bankruptcies. Harvey Miller, one of the most prominent bankruptcy attorneys in the country, who represented corporate debtors, described BAP CPA as totally ill-conceived, and BAP CPA is the acronym for the 2005 law. And we will continue to discuss this topic next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous day.